I would like to welcome everyone to the Action Campaign for October 21st. And our topic for today is Medicaid admissions, Medicaid collections, and is it possible to do both? We have two organizations that are presenting today. Victor Liu from Asian Counseling Referral Service in Seattle is going to be talking about decreasing wait time to increase Medicaid admissions. And Anita Lacey and Tammy Horn from Associated Centers for Therapy in Tulsa, Oklahoma, will be talking about how they increase their Medicaid collections. First, Victor is going to start us out, and he is a Washington Certified Chemical Dependency Professional and National Certified Addiction Counselor. He is Director of Recovery Services from Asian Counseling and Referral Services in Seattle. He supervises a recovery services department of mostly bilingual and bicultural staff of 16. He is also trained as a change leader under NIATEC's initiative. He was born in Singapore and is fluent in Cantonese, Hokkien, Mandarin, and Teochew Chinese dialects. With that, Victor, if you could please take it away and tell us about your experiences there at Seattle.
Great. So can everyone, so now I'm good to go, right, Rochelle?
You are good to go. Take it away, Victor.
Okay, so good morning again, everyone. And I'm Victor Liu from Seattle, Washington, from Asian Counseling Referral Service. And today I'm actually going to talk a little bit about our experience through the NITEX initiatives in 2004 when we were first funded. So on the first slide, you're going to see that it's just an overview of our substance abuse treatment program and our agency. So Asian Counseling and Referral Service, ACRS, is a nonprofit organization. It's actually one of the largest nonprofit organizations that serves the Asian Pacific Islander in Washington State. And our mission is to promote social justice and the well-being and empowerment of Asian Pacific Americans. And one of the things that we were funded by Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Path to Recovery in 2004. And since then, our program actually went through a lot of changes. We integrated process improvement into our program. And since 2004, we have spread that change exercises and process improvement and all the NITEX initiatives across program in all the whole agency. And our agency has has about 13 different programs, and we serve about 23,000 clients yearly. And our annual operating budget is about $13 million. So with the NITEX initiative, we were very fortunate that we were able to really integrate it and make some very effective changes that I would like to share with you today. So some of the changes we had implemented since in 2004 is the first proposed change that we proposed to NITEX when we first funded is a three collateral contacts in 3 days. It sounded very simple, and one thing I like about NITEX initiative is that it's not complicated. You just need to make some small changes, and then you will be able to create some very effective outcome. And the other thing that is good about NITEX initiative is that if the change is not effective, it's a rapid change cycle. So if you test it within a couple of weeks, you meet with the change team and you realize it's not effective, then you can just abandon the idea and then start fresh with a new concept. But the first change, again, the three collateral contacts in 3 days is we realized that before we implement this change that our intake assessor who did assessment is taking some time up to 1 week or even longer to actually finish the assessment summary. And the reason for that is he or she will just have to wait for all the collateral contacts from attorney or probation officer in order to complete assessment summary. So the change we implement is if our staff make three consensus collateral contacts in 3 days, 3 working days, then if whatever information we get in those 3 days, then we'll just go ahead and complete the assessment summary. And with that, we were able to increase the assessment and reduce the wait time. And you will see some data later on that I'll present. And then the second change is, again, it's a very simple change that exercise that we implement. We require all our staff to return phone calls in 1 day when their messages left for assessment services for screener voicemail. The screener will return calls in 1 day. Again, this sounds very simple, but the volume of assessment that was coming into our intake was very high. And sometimes able to answer the phone calls in one day. So we make sure that all our intake assessors answer the phone calls in one day. And also, we through doing this, we make sure that there's always a live person to answer the phone call. So on our phone system now, if the first the phone call was made to the intake office, if the main intake staff is not able to take the phone call, it can be routed to the second or the third person. So we do our best to make sure there's a live person to answer that phone call and return any voicemail in one day. And the third change is the paging system. So if there's any walk-in into our agency to request for an assessment, we will respond immediately. In the event that a staff is not at the desk to pick up the phone, our reception will page through the overhead system to page for any available program staff to respond to that walk-in. And the fourth one is a change that we make, that we added our backup assessment staff in addition to regular assessment staff that can provide assessment. So a client does not have to wait more than 5 days for assessment appointment. I should have updated this bullet. It's because right now our client actually do not need to wait for 2 working days. And in the event that the assessment is urgent, we can provide a same-day assessment. And since then, we had also centralized our intake to have an intake coordinator who does almost all the assessment. And then the other change on this slide that we implement is the same-day admission. As you know, that the engagement piece with client is very critical. If you see somebody that needs an assessment, and if they are somewhat motivated to receive treatment, we encourage them to through motivational interviewing and provide them with some cultural education about the benefits, such as if they get that treatment on the same day, it's going to help them more if they are mandated by the legal system to receive treatment. So another change is, as you know, in our line of work, there is a lot of paperwork. I'm sure I don't have to tell you about it. We have lots of documents that we have to fill out. So one thing that we did is we look at all our intake packets and all the forms that our staff have to fill out, and we streamline those paperwork and prioritize information. Because in Seattle, Washington, in the state, we are funded by the county and Washington State, there are required paperwork that we need to fill out, and it all needs to be entered into a database for the county and state system. So we look at those documents and determine what information are duplicated, so we don't have to ask the client the same question during assessment, and we streamline the paperwork process. And we also set up walk-in time. We have designated walk-in day to accommodate any clients that walk in. And the other thing, this is the piece that I'm going to speak more about today, is we partner with our mental health program to provide comprehensive assessment, meaning that if our mental health department through their intake, if they determine somebody with a substance abuse, possible substance abuse diagnosis or dependency diagnosis, we would actually partner with them to do a same-day assessment, so the client can come in to have the mental health assessment and the CD assessment on the same day. So we integrate these changes into our outreach program to increase Medicaid clients' admission, and we also integrate these similar changes to our youth substance abuse treatment program. And in our department, we also have a problem gambling treatment program, and we integrate all the changes that I just mentioned into all these 3 major programs. And how do we know that the changes we implemented actually work? So if you look at our days between first contact to first treatment, meaning somebody who call on that day to request for an appointment, and then they get assessed, and how fast do they get admitted to start treatment, you see a very dramatic increase that in 2004, it actually takes pretty long for somebody to get into treatment. It can take as long as 90 days after the first contact and then assessment. But as on today, we are able, like I said, we can provide a same-day assessment if it's an urgent request. If not, we can provide an assessment appointment within 2 days, and we also provide same-day admission. So this, to us, is a very dramatic outcome to all the changes we implemented. And also, the Medicaid clients that we served from 2004 up to August 2008, that is when our NITECs, our RWJ funding ended in 2006, but we continue to collect this data in partnership with NITEC until 2008. And you can see that this is a very, very dramatic increase and effective way to show that the number of Medicaid clients that we have served since 2004 until 2008 had almost, it has more than doubled from each year, as you can see. And this is a continuing trend even until now in 2010. And not just, so the overall clients that we served from 2004 to August 2008, and again, you can see it's an ongoing increase. We double our capacity at the end of the data collection with NYTEX. And again, until now, this is continuing to be an upward trend for us. And for all nonprofit organizations, the key thing is always sustainability, especially right now with the country facing a recession. But some, I like to think it's a depression, but however, there's a thing that says that when the going gets tough, the tough gets going. But it's really great that we are able to use all these NYTEX changes to not only really meet the outcomes of the four aims under the NYTEX initiative, increase the Medicaid admission, increase the non-Medicaid admission, but through that, we are also able to increase the revenue very steadily, and that has really helped us in our sustainability. Back in 2008, our department was faced with an unexpected $500,000 budget cut at the beginning of January, and that is in 2008. But very quickly, we were able to bring our team together. There were about 8 staff that were affected by the unexpected $500,000 budget cut, and we were able to very quickly put together a very quick change exercise, and we were able, I'm glad to report that we were able to sustain all its staff that were facing layoffs at that time, and all staff are still working with us. And I think that a lot of it has to do with the NYTEX changes that we implemented. And so this is some of the data that I just wanted to share with you. So in comparison with August 2004 until the end of 2007, we made 91% improvement in engaging our clients from the point of first contact. And compared with 2004, ACRS has 210% increase in Medicaid clients to date. So again, just look at the percentage, it's dramatic. And compared with 2004, ACRS has 46% increase in non-Medicaid clients to date. The other thing is also that King County and Washington State treatment retention rates are about 63% and 62% respectively, and ACRS rate is about 84%. So the definition of treatment retention is a client who stays in treatment for at least 90 days, because many studies have demonstrated that when a client stays in treatment for more than 90 days, they are more likely to complete treatment. And we compare our rates with the county and the state. You can see that our rate is above average. And also another thing that we measure is treatment completion rates, meaning somebody who successfully completed treatment. So for King County, the treatment completion rate is about 47%, and the state is about 48%. And for ACRS, the treatment completion rate is averaging at 70%, meaning somebody who is admitted into treatment in our agency, about 70% of them successfully completed at least an average of 1 year treatment. And that is the end of the presentation. I know that it went very quickly, and I know that you may have some questions for me, and I'll be ready to answer them at the end of the presentation. And here are my key contacts and our deputy director key contact. She's also a NYTEX coach that provides coaching to other states in the nation. And so I look forward to answering your questions later on. Thank you.
Thank you, Victor, for sharing that information. I am going to transition over to Tammy and Anita's presentation. And while I'm doing that, we do have a question here from Tim who asks, how do you measure your retention rate?
That's a very good question. So one thing that we learned from NYTEX is that data collection is very effective when it comes to advocacy. So when a client gets admitted into treatment, we have a database that is integrated through the state system that we measure every single treatment activity, from a phone contact to a home visit to an individual contact to a group contact. So we wanted to make sure that if there has been no individual contact with the client for X number of days, our staff make engagement very quickly with the client, and we wanted to make sure that we continue to engage the clients for at least 90 days to make sure that the clients make a full transition and complete intensive outpatient treatment before they move on to outpatient treatment. I hope that answers your question.
I'm sorry, I'm running between two locations here.
Multitasking.
Wendy does have a question for you on how did you bring in more Medicaid clients?
Okay. So in the story I shared earlier on that within ACRS we also have a mental health program. So we actually started from that area because there are many mental health clients that they also have substance abuse diagnoses that are undetected. So we did many engaging with, we started with the line staff, the mental health counselor in our agency. We provided them with training and education on how to provide screening for the mental health clients for substance abuse. And through that, then they refer clients to us. So that was one of the things that we did to increase Medicaid clients. The second thing that we did is in King County in our state, there are about 10 community service offices. So we call them commonly known as a welfare office. So we also partner with different welfare offices, social worker and administrator, to present about our program. And so we went there to do presentation, and we realized that the staff that will really refer, the one that are going to refer clients to our intake staff is really the staff, the social workers working with the Medicaid clients at their welfare offices. So we identified all the lead contacts and we partnered with them and we offered ourselves to be outstationed and provide assessment at their offices so the clients do not have to come to us. And to retain them, because clients are on welfare or they're on some medical benefits, we also work with a financial planner and social worker and let them know that if the clients are not compliant or not motivated to receive treatment, then they work with the clients to tell them that their benefits may be sanctioned. So there is an external motivation to make sure that the clients stay engaged and continue to retain in treatment. I hope that answers your question, Wendy.
Great, thank you. This is Scott at NIA Texas. I'm just filling in for Rochelle quickly. The next question we have is, how do you measure completion? This comes from Lee Graham. How do you measure completion? And the other question was, clean for how long?
Yes, that is a very good question. So the way that we measure treatment completion is that one thing is, a lot of treatment providers has the abstinence policy that once a client enters treatment, they have to be absent from alcohol or any other drugs. But as I'm trained as a clinician, and I just think that at some point that may not be practical. So we started with a harm reduction model, and the ultimate goal is to get them to have clean UA. So if a person comes in, for, let's say, with a very high THC level for marijuana or maybe positive for methamphetamine, then the goal is using a urine analysis to use the harm reduction model to hope that that whatever that is being measured got reduced and ultimately being clean, clean UA. And that can be a long process, and sometimes the treatment recommendation can be 1 year, but it's not uncommon for us to extend the treatment to 2 years. And also the way that we measure treatment completion is, I'm sure everyone is familiar with ASAM PPC, based on the six dimension, and those are items that are identified and in the client's treatment plan that the client agreed upon. So if the client has fulfilled the objectives in the treatment plan that is based on ASAM, then the client will be considered to complete treatment. I hope that answers your question, Lee.
Thank you, Victor. And I'm sorry I missed out on Wendy's question here, but she did respond back and said yes, so I hope that makes sense. Now we're going to transition over to Anita and Tammy's presentation, which I have loaded here. But before we do that, talk about PDSA cycles and stuff, and I'm doing one right now. And if you could just indicate how many people are viewing the webinar today from your location, and you can just check the one that applies. For your organization. While you're doing that, I'd like to introduce Anita and Tammy. And they are with Associated Centers for Therapy in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Anita Lacey came to ACT 2 years ago from a single physician's office in private practice, where she developed her skills in Medicare collections. She used those skills to create the Medicaid collection process, and Anita holds a BBA in accounting from Pittsburgh State University in Pittsburgh, Kansas. Tammy has worked at ACT for over 20 years and holds a BBA in accounting from Langston University in Tulsa. She is a member of the agency's leadership team, and she joined ACT when the agency served less than 1,000 people, had less than $1 million budget, and only 23 employees. And today they serve over 5,000 people, have 120 employees, and nearly a $9 million budget. With that, Tammy and Anita, we'd like to hear your story on how you increase Medicaid collections.
Hi, this is Tammy Horn. I have Anita Lacey here with me, and we're going to talk about our project to complete our Medicaid, increase our Medicaid collections. First, I want to give you a little history regarding some changes in Medicaid in the state of Oklahoma. In 2006, no services to Medicaid clients required authorization. As the years came along, they began changing that. They started requiring authorization for some services, and by 2009, they were requiring authorization for 100% of services provided through our agency. As they made these changes, our denial rate, of course, began to increase, and by 2009, we were at a 35% denial rate. When Anita came in, her primary functions were to, her primary functions were to reconcile payments received and research Medicaid denials and make submissions where she identified that we could. As she began doing this, she realized that we had a large number of denials that actually appeared to be collectible. Her estimate at that time was that about 50% of what was denied could be collected. We basically developed two goals from what she had identified. The first was to collect these services that had been previously denied. The second was to identify what was causing these denials so that we could reduce denials in the future. As Anita researched, she actually went back over 2 years and found 14,000 claims that had been denied. Our estimate, again, was about 50% of these could be collected. Our first project, we were trying to find the fastest way to submit and collect these funds. Our first project was basically to use the entire department to collect these funds. We would shut down the department for a day, and everyone would work on denials. What we found from this is it was really an inefficient use of our most valuable resource, which was Anita herself. She was spending all of her time teaching everyone else how to understand the denial, interpret it, and resubmit the service so that we could get paid. So we changed our process from this, had Anita now focus on all the denials, identify what the problem was, what needed to be done to correct it, and if she identified a group of denials, she would train an individual on how to resubmit and collect those claims. That made the process work much more smoothly and quickly. Some of the errors that I found that I had to deal with actually are quite common. A lot of the billing codes that we were using were not matching up to what the authorizations number allotted for. So that was the first thing I needed to kind of reconcile. Also, we had some other general issues, such as there were units that needed to be corrected. Perhaps they were in a manner that Medicaid didn't accept, such as 0.68, 2.39, something strange like that. And I think the biggest one was the duplication error. As I began to research this, this was a new field to me. There would be several services, the same type service that would be billed for the same day. But with Medicaid, you could only bill that service one time a day. So what we actually believed were duplicate services were not actual duplicate services. They were the same service on the same day, but a different time. So those were things that when I could identify them, I would be able to give to someone else to combine the services and bill as one service for that day. Other things that were identified were name and number mismatches. Either the name was one letter off from what Medicaid may have had, or a number has been keyed in incorrectly. There were also issues with the authorization. We have several locations, and many times a location would be on authorization would be on a location, but not where the service was provided. That was a quick fix in that I submitted location correction, and that would be something that I could pass off to another person to correct. Medicaid has a wonderful screen that shows all of the denied claims, and I could copy that off and give that to someone else and give them a time frame as to when they could begin resubmitting these claims as soon as I was able to determine that the authorization had been changed. This was very time-consuming and very exhausting, but as Tammy's going to show, it really paid off. It was very tiring, but I was very grateful for my boss who put up with me quite a bit. Let's see, I was looking at something else. Another thing that I had to deal with in all of these corrections was not only the denials themselves, but there were numerous authorization corrections that I had to keep track of as well. And I also had to develop a system to keep track of those that, and they came back, or if they didn't come back, I could check on them to find out where they were. ATS worked diligently. In fact, I talked with them several times, and they said, yes, we've noticed that you've had many location requests for authorization. So that was quite a problem that we had, which I believe is on its way to being fastly resolved. Results of the work that Anita and others in the department did were an increase in our Medicaid collections in fiscal year 10. We went from an average of $665,000 to $1.7 million. In fiscal year 10. Of that $1.7 million, $639,000 of that was for previous years. So our actual collections for the fiscal year increased to about $1 million. Our expectation is that that will be sustained over following years. During the time that Anita was doing this, we also developed a spreadsheet where we could keep track of the types of denials that we were receiving so that we could reach our secondary goal, which is decrease the number of denials that we're getting. Anita has actually already mentioned to you the most common ones: obtaining an authorization on the wrong contract, or obtaining an authorization for one type of service when we actually ended up providing another, which is a matter of just changing your authorization. Also, the appearance of a duplicate service when it's actually just two different services on the same day. Our next steps are to decrease the amount of time it takes us to work a denial. From the date a service is provided until we have worked processed all of the denials and collected them is right now between 60 and 90 days. Our goal is to get that down to 45 days. Our second goal, which we are now working on, is to make sure that staff are fully trained in the specific errors that can be made that increase denials. Making sure that we have correct name and number, making sure our authorization correct are on the correct contract. Basically, what we've managed to do is increase our agency cash flows by about $300,000 every year. We have reduced our Medicaid denials from the 35% they were at in 2008 and 2009 down to 17.5% today. Our goal is to get that to below 15%. That's basically our presentation.
Thank you, Anita and Tammy. It's very interesting. I can't imagine how much that has helped your organization. In all the work that you've done with this, have you been able to get some additional staff to help you do some of this?
Anita actually put in some overtime for this. For the backlog, she worked about an additional 20 hours a week. We did use some temporary staff for a short period of time, but most of the work was handled by the department, by everyone here in the department.
Super. We do have a question here from Angela that says, what type of Medicaid services was your agency requesting?
We're a community mental health center. Our services are primarily individual therapy, group therapy, case management services. We also have a psychosocial rehab program. One of the more common areas would be, during the time of these denials, individual therapy was requested in 20 to 30 minute sessions, 30 to 40 minute sessions, and 60 to 75 minute sessions. And if you requested a 40 to 45 minute session and provided a 60 minute session, you got a denial. Another would be to have case management requested, and then end up needing more individual rehab services, which results in the need to change the authorization request.
Thank you. I would like to remind people that you can submit your questions through the chat box. And if you have a specific one for Anita and Tammy or for Victor, we'd be glad to take those now. And if you could just indicate if it was Victor or Tammy and Anita. We do have another question here that says from Lee that says, in making collections for previously denied claims, do you still have to adhere to the not billing services rendered greater than 1 year?
Actually, in Oklahoma, I cannot answer for sure for other states, the services cannot be more than 12 months old, unless the denial is the result of a data entry error. What we have actually learned is that just about any denial can be considered the result of a data entry error. If you have requested an authorization on one contract, the service is actually provided on another contract, that's a data entry error. So you can go back up to 24 months and collect that. If you request individual rehab and you provide case management, that can actually be a data entry error. So you really can go back 24 months for most services.
Thank you. I have a question here from Francine, and she says, have you had to address many denials for OHC, other health care coverage?
Yes, we have. In that instance, at this point, we're still looking at a very effective way to address that. We are submitting those claims to what Medicaid considers a third-party liability payer, or kind of a a prior or a primary health care payer for those. One thing we do run into that type of situation is a lot of these don't necessarily have a behavioral health coverage. So that is something that I kind of take to with the claims. I haven't really dealt with a whole lot of those in the past couple of months. That was kind of early on.
Thank you. I would like to remind participants to please do *6 to mute your phone. I undid the mass mute, so if you haven't muted your phone, I think we can hear somebody who is typing on their keyboard. We would appreciate your muting your phone. We have a question here from Wendy, and she says, do you know if the same data entry rule applies to federal Medicaid also?
No, I don't know the answer to that.
You did, as you talked to the agency that provides the oversight for Medicaid in the state of Oklahoma, and asked those questions, and that really helped a lot.
Okay.
So whatever agency it is that handles your Medicaid collections in your state and payments in your state, that would probably be the best resource. Like you were talking about here in Oklahoma, it's the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority, and the payment method is through APS. Is that correct?
APS is the
authorization agent. So you might look at the direction that you have to go to wherever your contract is, and then ask them that question directly.
Thank you. While we're waiting for more questions to come in here, if there are individuals out there that would like to ask a question over the phone, you are welcome to do that, and you can just do *6 to unmute your phone. We do have another question here from Angela. She says, are there different types of Medicaid in your state, and if so, did you need to apply to be a provider for those separate Medicaid companies?
No, we just have the one Medicaid provider, and that's the Oklahoma Health Care Authority. We refer to it as OHCA, and that was already in place. It is I believe it's a contract renewal every 2 years, 3 years. I'm not for certain. I don't deal directly with the contract renewals.
Mm-hmm.
Can I answer your question? I hope it does.
If there's anyone else out there in the audience that might be able to answer that question, please feel free to see how it might apply in your state. We have a question here from Mark that says, the problem with asking local authority about interpretation issues like data entry error is that it can lead to more restrictive interpretations. This happened in Florida when someone asked about the IMD rule. And I think that's just a statement from Mark. I don't know if you want to make any comment on that. Angela also responded back a yes here. And then we have a question here from Vernie. And what were some of the things that you did to decrease claims from being denied again? One of the biggest issues we have is that a claim may be denied, and then after resent two or three times, it is paid.
How did you manage to get payments with the first resubmission? I know you did have some issues where you did several resubmissions.
Well, I think after I got a little smarter as I went along, I had to really take a look at what it was denied for to see. In fact, I called the local OHCA a number of times to ask specifically if I couldn't get a claim to pay and I felt like it should. I called them and I asked them what's wrong with this claim, and they would tell me, and then I'd make that correction and send it in. Sometimes I could figure it out on my own. Sometimes it was just like an eye thing. I mean, my eye wasn't picking it up, and like two numbers were just off. but I was on the phone a lot. I called them a lot. Learned a lot.
Thank you. Jacqueline responds here to answer Angela's question. Yes, you have to sign up with a BHO. And then also Tina says here, I am Teresa from Florida. You do have to credential with all plans. All right. While we're waiting for some more questions to come in, I would like to put up another poll here, and I did this with our call last week, but if you could just indicate here, and you should be able to indicate what you do bill for, Medicaid, Medicare, third-party billing, or if you're not billing, and we'd just like to get an idea here. One thing I'd also encourage people, if you haven't gone to NIATX's website to look at the billing guide, I would encourage you to do that. We do have some hard copies available. If anyone would like a hard copy, you could please let me know, and I'd be glad to send you one. But you can look at the PDF file on the website, and you should be able to print it from there. All right, and it looks like people are still responding to that poll. It looks like about 34 of you, and we have about 75 people on the webinar today, are billing for Medicaid. About 11% of you are billing for Medicare, and about 22% of you are third-party billing, and there are a couple that are not billing at this time. I'm going to close the poll, and I believe I should be able to show this learning here, going through my PDFA cycle. Are there any questions for Victor and what they have been able to accomplish in Seattle? Victor, do you have any comments as far as, you know, since you've done this PDFA cycle and where you're at today, do you have any comments?
The only comments I have is that I just think that the PDFA cycle is just a very effective tool that all providers really should be training the staff to use it. And again, we started with just our department, and then now we're integrating it throughout the agency. And so everything that we do here now, it's just integrated into the way that we do things here at ACRS. And so each department has their own change team, which actually really helps us to implement many effective changes very quickly. So if your agency has more than one different department and you're the only department that is only using PDFA, I encourage you to really get the other departments trained as well and just integrate it throughout the agency.
And one thing I'd like to comment on that as well, if people are interested in talking with Victor or with Tammy and Anita, I will be posting their email addresses on the website, so you will be able to contact them directly. We do have about 10 more minutes here if anyone else has any questions or comments. We do have time to take those. And again, if you are on the phone, you can do *6 to unmute your phone and ask your question live. While we're waiting for any more questions here, I would like to put up another poll here to find out the value of today's webinar. And if you could just indicate if you will be able to use the information you receive from today's webinar. And you can just indicate that on the poll there. In the meantime, we have received another question here from Mark, and he says, he's asking if we can show the poll results here. And I am learning as I go here, and I can tell you from the current poll that you're doing that about 62% of the people on the call do believe that they'll be able to use the information today. Let me try closing the poll here and see if it will allow me to show you the results. There we go. Now you should be able to see the results from the poll on the presentation presentations today. I'm also going to bring back the one on what you bill for, and both those as well. Right, so you should be able to see both of those polling results. All right. One last request for questions here. Otherwise, in closing, Tammy and Anita, do you have any closing remarks?
Well, I would just say, in working your denials, to don't believe anything that you see there. Consider everything collectible and until it's not collected. A lot of the denials that I really kind of saw, they had more symptomology than a real true denial.
The fact that you thought you were going to collect 50% and you actually collected 90% was a real eye-opener, too.
Yes, it was, and a nice one. But I would say persevere with it, because most of the time it really probably is collectible, but if you give up, you lose.
Thank you very much. Well, I would like to thank Victor Liu from Seattle and Anita and Tammy from Tulsa for sharing their stories in dealing with Medicaid admissions and collections. And the recording for this webinar will be posted on the Action Campaign website of NIATX's website, which is www.niatx.net. And you can just click on the home page where it says Action Campaign, and you can go to the webinar library. You are also able to check out any past webinars that we've held since we began the Action 2 campaign in August of 2009. And if you have any comments or suggestions for future webinars, I would love to hear those. And my email address is Rochelle, Rochelle, Green, Green, at chess, CHESS, .wisc.edu. And again, thank you to our presenters and thank you for participating in today's webinar. Stay tuned for information on our November webinars, the second Tuesday of November, the 9th, and the third Thursday of November. And we will hear from you next month. Thank you.